Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Today on the show, we'll have three stories on healthcare issues, including what happens when kids don't have health insurance.
They get stomach bugs, they get colds, they get high temperatures, they fall, things happen to kids.
Also, the governor and others in Wyoming are looking into why Native American women suffer such high rates of violence. One family lost their daughter and wants justice.
That's the only way we're going to get closer. These guys get put in jail, get justice, you know, prosecute the lawless.
The state's largest water project is nearing the end of a 10-year expansion process.
It's important to be able to provide the water service that's needed for those areas to expand.
Plus tips on how you should behave at a powwow. Those stories and more on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. Wyoming is a pretty good place to be a kid, and the 2019 Kids Count data book agrees. Their report released this week gave the Equality State high marks for education and economic well-being. But when it comes to health, we're second to last in the nation. Wyoming Public Radio's Tennessee Watson takes a look at why.
One big reason children's health in Wyoming is weak compared to the rest of the nation is 10% of kids in the state are without health insurance. According to the Kids Count data book from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, that's twice the national average. And while most states have improved over the last 10 years, the situation in Wyoming has gotten slightly worse. Katie Doherty says that's a problem because no matter where kids live, they get sick.
They get stomach bugs, they get colds, they get high temperatures, they fall, things happen to kids.
Doherty is the nurse manager for the Albany Community Health Clinic in Laramie, and she says without insurance, kids are at risk.
Not having adequate health care, proper vaccinations, they end up with more chronic diseases.
She sees a lot of uninsured kids because the clinic offers a sliding scale fee option for uninsured families who have to pay out of pocket. But Doherty says even at a reduced cost, they'll hold off on a visit until they absolutely need care. Part of the problem is jobs with health benefits have been on the decline in Wyoming. That's according to Lisa Knapp, a senior research analyst with the Wyoming Department of Workforce Services.
In 2010, 68.7% of all jobs were offered medical insurance. By 2017, Q3, only 60% of all jobs were offered medical insurance.
And Knapp says the decline in employer-based insurance hit part-time workers the hardest.
Among part-time workers, this had dropped by more than half. So in 2010, Q1, 23.7% of part-time employees were offered medical insurance. But in 2017, Q3, only 10.4% were offered the benefit.
Employers aren't required to provide insurance for workers who clock less than 30 hours. And when finances get tight, that's an easy place to make a cut. Businesses with less than 50 full-time employees are also exempt. So for parents who don't have access to employer-based insurance,
there's actually a number of ways for children to get coverage.
Jan Stahl with the Wyoming Department of Health oversees eligibility for the Wyoming Medicaid program and Wyoming KidCare, also known as CHIP. These programs serve kids from families with household incomes at or below 200% of the federal poverty level. That's just under $52,000 for a family of four.
Any children that apply for Medicaid or CHIP, if we deny that case for being over income, we automatically send that application to the federally facilitated marketplace. So that would be another option for families.
The federal marketplace, established by the Affordable Care Act, offers subsidized plans, but Stahl says it's up to families to enroll and pay the premium, and sometimes they can't.
Wyoming insurance rates tend to be on the higher side, and some families, just with the small amounts they're making, may not be able to afford that.
Stahl says one way to cover more kids would be to increase the income limit for the CHIP program. But that would cost the state more money and require approval from the state legislature.
There are states out there, many states that go up to $250, $300, some even go up to $350. So, you know, I'm sure there's children that if we had a higher income limit that we would be able to cover more.
But even with the current requirements, Stahl says there are thousands of kids who are eligible but not enrolled. The Wyoming Department of Health says it does outreach, puts ads in local newspapers, and shows up for community events. But there are still parents out there who don't sign up their kids. Nurse Katie Doherty from the Albany Community Health Clinic says she's heard from parents who are reluctant to get involved with government bureaucracy.
There could be a stigma easily associated with labeling yourself as part of that lower socioeconomic class because my child is on Medicaid. Those are all kind of against that Western culture that we have here.
The clinic's office manager, Jamie Nipchin, says in addition to shame and stigma, the process is just overwhelming.
It is burdensome. If you look at the application, it's very thick. And for some people, it might be a time thing. It might be an education thing, whether or not they're able to trudge through that paperwork.
So clinic staff do what they can to make it less daunting. Sometimes that's making copies or phone calls, or just sitting with someone as they fill out the 20-page form. Nipchin would like to see Wyoming devote more resources to that kind of direct support. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Tennessee Watson.
When you live in a rural place, basic services aren't just down the street, and that includes a doctor's office or emergency room. For people living with a chronic condition, that can make life complicated. Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen reports on one program attempting to help rural patients.
Gary and Celeste Havner live 40 miles outside of Laramie in southeast Wyoming. They spend a lot of their time growing vegetables and riding horses across the prairie.
And anytime you get on a horse, anything can happen.
A few weeks ago, Celeste fell off her horse.
I had a very ungraceful dismount and tweaked my knee pretty good.
Afterwards, she laid on the ground for a while, trying to figure out how hurt she was, but also wondering if a visit to the doctor was worth it.
After it didn't get better, I did go to town.
This kind of decision-making is something she and her husband do often, since they both have other health issues. Gary deals with pain from injuries working as a carpenter, and Celeste just recently wrapped up radiation treatment for breast cancer.
I think most rural people choose doctor denial as their first choice. Dr. Google is their second choice.
In a recent poll by NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, 26% of rural Americans say there's been a time in the past few years when they needed health care but did not get it. A majority of them say it was because financial barriers kept them from seeing a doctor, but almost a quarter of them say it was because health care was too far or difficult to get to. That's where Janet Korpela comes in.
In a rural area, if someone can manage their own health better and go to the doctor less often, then that's a win for everybody.
Today, she's running a leader training with 8 volunteers for a program called Healthy You. They arrange tables in a circle so participants can all face one another. The people from this training will go back into their communities to teach patients living with chronic conditions how to better manage their health. These leaders don't need a medical background. Korpela says they just need to be willing to do the 40 hours of free training.
This curriculum is really designed to be led by peer leaders, which means that the leaders should be equivalent or equal to the people who will eventually be taking the workshops.
One of the things volunteers do in the training is role play. Korpela is in the role of patient.
My action plan was to take my prescribed medication daily on time as prescribed, and I didn't do that.
Volunteers learn to brainstorm solutions. Melanie Pierce and Don Garrison have a few ideas.
Take your medicine with a regular activity.
I said put it by the toothpaste, so when you brush your teeth in the morning, you take it first thing in the morning. I'm assuming that you brush your teeth
every. This is called action planning, and studies show it's effective at improving quality of life and reducing the number of doctor visits or hospitalization.
I mean, I think we tend to think of it as a medical issue in the sense of disease management, like you just need to go to the doctor or take your medication.
That's Anna DeHooge. She's one of 62 people in Wyoming to complete the leader training. She's a nutritionist at a hospital in Cheyenne, and the majority of her patients deal with a chronic condition.
Hopefully people will realize, oh, well, I'm not a healthcare doctor, I'm not a nurse, but I do have these skills, so I can help my friend with chronic disease by doing this.
For DeHooge, she decided to do the training as a way to make her community a healthier place to live. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
When we come back, we will look at concerns over hospital costs and bring you serious concerns about the high rates of violence faced by Native American women. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. A recent report found that Wyoming hospitals are charging private insurance way more than Medicare. The report raised some eyebrows about why that may be the case and if hospitals are overcharging. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska has more.
The RAND report found that 14 Wyoming hospitals charge private insurance more than three times on average than what Medicare pays for the same service. In some cases, it was 400 to 500% more. Cheyenne Regional Medical Center was one of the hospitals.
You know, our outpatient relationship of private payment to Medicare payments was a 480% factor. That was a little distressing.
That's Neil Bertrand, the chief financial officer at the Cheyenne Regional Medical Center. He's not surprised that it would bill private insurance more than they bill Medicare, just not to that extent. In fact, when Bertrand looked into it, he says RAND used insufficient data, noting that they only looked at 169 sample insurance claims.
So 169 statistics on 78,000 is about 0.2%. That's a pretty low basis to draw any conclusions on.
Bertrand says the reason they do charge more for those who do not use Medicare is because the reimbursement levels are extremely low.
For our 2018 fiscal year, we received $98 million from Medicare, but the cost of care for all of those Medicare patients, in and outpatient, was $134 million. So we've got a $36 million annual shortfall for Medicare that isn't reimbursed.
And it's not just Cheyenne. Eric Boley is the president of the Wyoming Hospital Association. He says the problem extends across the state.
Payment from Medicare doesn't cover the cost of delivering care to Medicare patients. It's actually done at a loss. It's about 11% loss for our facilities to provide care to Medicare patients.
So hospitals have to find the money they're losing.
It's not uncommon, and it's pretty much standard, that commercial insurance are going to be charged more than Medicare because Medicare doesn't cover the actual cost of delivering care.
This is called cost shifting. Hospitals can get surplus money by charging commercial insurance more for the same service. They are also doing this to make up for those that are uninsured. But Boley says even insurance doesn't pay 100% of the cost. Of course, some think that's because hospitals are overcharging to begin with. The Wyoming legislature is currently studying why Wyoming hospital costs seem to be higher than other states. And Ann Ladd with the Wyoming Business Coalition on Health shares a similar concern. Ladd's organization provided the Wyoming data for the report. She says to blame everything on Medicare is unfair.
No, it isn't a matter of us raising our prices. It's a matter of hospitals getting their cost structures under control.
Ladd says this aggregated data is an important tool.
We could look at costs in Wyoming versus costs in any other state. So to me, this was a rare opportunity for an apples-to-apples comparison.
But Boley says it's not surprising that Wyoming hospital costs would be so high when you consider they have to pay doctors and others a national rate.
60 to 70% of hospital costs are in salaries around our state. It's expensive to recruit and retain staff. We end up paying, in a lot of cases, more than you would in surrounding states.
In the past, hospital administrators have noted that Wyoming hospitals don't have the volume of patients that they have in other states to raise enough revenue to pay some of these salaries. Still, Ladd wants private businesses who provide private insurance to their employees to work with local hospital administrations to stop putting such a burden on employers. She says that might include a more accurate cost system. Neil Bertrand with Cheyenne Regional Medical Center says they have always been actively searching for a more efficient cost system.
We're coming at it every way we can. We just want to make sure we're getting value for the money we write checks for.
The legislative study on hospital costs should be available later this year. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kudalska at the Center of the West in Cody.
Changing gears, at a march last month on the University of Wyoming campus, Governor Mark Gordon announced a decision to create a task force to study the problem of missing and murdered Indigenous women in Wyoming. As Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports, a gap in data makes it unclear just how systemic the issue is here. But nationally, it's believed that Native American women experience violence at rates 10 times the national average. A warning, this story may be disturbing to some audiences.
It's been 7 years now since Dawn Day was found floating in a Fremont County lake by a passing boat. But still, every day, her dad, Gregory Day, and her aunt, Madeline Day, still miss her laughter.
She was crazy.
Crazy in a good way, huh?
Yeah.
Make you laugh, you know.
That's what she did. She always wanted everybody to be happy.
And Madeline says it was that always trying to make people happy that kept her from leaving an abusive boyfriend.
She has that puppy dog syndrome, you know, like, I can fix you, you can't. How are you going to fix somebody that strangles you, throws you out of a car, that throws you in a fire, you know? That's not love. You can't fix them.
It's a message Madeline tried to express the last time she saw Dawn.
When we saw her, she had a black eye. We were trying to make her come with us, and she's like, I'll be all right. What was the last time we saw her?
The autopsy called Dawn Day's death undetermined because there was more than one possible cause. But Gregory and Madeline say they know what killed her, and it wasn't drowning.
There was no water in her lungs. Her lips weren't blue. She was just beaten to death.
And so, like in many Native women's deaths, Dawn Day's was never classified as a homicide. But Gregory and Madeline say law enforcement should have interviewed more people, like a neighbor who lived upstairs from Dawn and her boyfriend. Madeline ran into the woman when she went to pick up Dawn's belongings.
She was hysterical. You know, she heard her screaming and pounding and beating and scared her, and she said she had called the police and nobody came, and she said she was scared to leave her apartment.
In the end, no one was charged in the case, but it's never been closed. Madeline and Gregory continue to run into Dawn's boyfriend in the community. Now Madeline is worried that her own daughter will be next, since she too is in an abusive relationship.
If she don't get some kind of help, she's going to be laying right next to my niece.
Lynette Grable is the director of Not Our Native Daughters, a group working to educate the public about solutions to violence in Indian Country. She has very personal reasons for doing this work.
You know, there was a horrible day in my life where he put a gun to my head and put a few bullets in there and spin the wheel and pulled the trigger. And I remember that day, and I remember praying in my head, that asking God, if he lets me out of here, I will never come back to him ever again. And that's what I did.
Grable says her story and Dawn Day's aren't uncommon. At a high school on the Wind River Reservation recently,
when I asked the audience how many had either missing or murdered family members in their own family, I would say at least 40% of the room hands went up.
Such experiences prompted her to speak up during the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women's March in April. Grable addressed Governor Mark Gordon directly, asking him to take action. Then Governor Gordon got up.
Thank you, Lynette, for your comment about we need to do a task force. Senator Ellis and I just talked about, let's do this. So we will.
He's referring to Cheyenne Senator and Navajo Tribal Member Afi Ellis. Ellis worked on a 2015 congressional report called A Roadmap for Making Native America Safer. She says a task force is still a baby step.
I'm always a little reluctant to be too excited about a task force.
But she says it could help get more data about how many Native women are disappearing in Wyoming. She'd like to get Wyoming's Division of Criminal Investigation access to national missing persons data. That way, the Attorney General can figure out who's going missing where. Ella says the state can also help implement an Amber Alert system on the Wind River Reservation to help find Native girls who disappear. But when it comes to investigating murders, Ellis says the state's hands are tied.
We have a very complicated jurisdictional maze, depending on who, the race of the victim, the race of the perpetrator, and where the crime occurred. It will depend on who has jurisdiction, either the state, the federal government, or tribes.
Which is why some cases, like Don Day's, fall through the cracks. Ellis plans to start addressing these problems at the task force's first meeting in Fort Washakie on August 19th. Don Day's father, Gregory, still holds out hope that law enforcement will someday arrest his daughter's killer.
That's the only way we're going to get closure. Mm-hmm. These guys get put in jail, get justice, you know, prosecute the lawless.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
When we come back, we'll tell you about an important water project and some tips on how to behave at a powwow. This is Open Spaces.
Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. Thanks to long-term growth, Gillette has been in dire need of an expansion to their existing water supply. Soon, a more than 10-year effort to expand the existing system will come online, providing water to those residents and possibly others. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler reports on what officials say is the largest water project in state history.
It's a sunny and warm Friday in northeast Wyoming. Levi Jensen is driving us east on Highway 51 out of Gillette. Jensen is a utility project manager for Gillette. We're driving along the pipelines that currently bring water into the city. It's not necessarily a tourist attraction.
Yeah, it's right in the ditch here. You obviously can't see it because it's buried. Like that yellow post right there is a test station for the pipeline.
Jensen oversees the Gillette-Madison Pipeline Project, which carries water from the Madison Aquifer in Crook County and brings it into Gillette, where it supplies the city and some of the surrounding areas with water. Jensen says the city has been working on expanding access to the water for years.
We've grown in both residential, commercial, industrial type areas, and it's important to be able to provide the water service that's needed for those areas to expand.
Gillette drilled its first Madison wells in the 1980s when the population boomed and its in-town sources couldn't keep up with the demand. Those wells were enough until the mid-2000s when the city knew they needed another expansion to keep up with the growing energy business and population.
To do that, we have to drill new wells out in the Madison Aquifer. We had to build a new pipeline parallel to the pipeline we had built in the 80s and a few other upgrades to the system.
The city didn't have enough money on its own, so state officials approved a mix of loans and grants to get to work on those upgrades. The project is budgeted at more than $217 million. But with that funding came a request from a Wyoming Water Development Commission official who wanted the city to consider an addition to the project.
We needed to become a regional provider.
Meaning Gillette would need to allow water districts outside the city to hook onto the system. The regional expansion is an additional $60 million project. Brian Clerkin of the Wyoming Water Development Commission says the regional expansion helps provide consistent, safe drinking water in the area, and it can save the residents and the state money.
If we didn't do a regional system, then each of those districts would want to have their own water system. And so from a state funding perspective, that starts to add up to be a lot of money.
One example of a place that has a need is Crook County. Some private wells went bad around the time the city was drilling its new wells for the pipeline. Senator Ogden Driscoll represents parts of Campbell, Crook, and Weston counties, including the area with the Madison well fields.
And that led to an immediate crunch for those landowners for both livestock and domestic water. And they approached me for help in the possibility of hooking on to the Gillette-Madison pipeline.
It didn't come easy, but after more than a year of tension and negotiations between Gillette, Driscoll, and Crook County landowners, the final deal allows for 5 taps for the landowners and leaves the option open if they want to form their own water district and formally hook onto the Gillette system. Driscoll says getting his constituents clean water is the main focus and that the final deal is fair to all groups involved.
It also provides for the ability for those areas served by it to grow because water is a limiting factor in Wyoming. And it's going to allow them to be able to provide potable water for future growth of both counties.
Driscoll says that water can be acquired more cheaply than if the communities did it themselves. Clerkin with the Water Commission says Gillette identified around 40 water districts that could hook onto the regional system, and about half have signed up so far. And any future growth depends on what the system can support.
Ultimately, it's going to be limited by the capacity of the pipeline and the wells that are supplying the water to the pipeline.
For now, the Gillette-Madison Pipeline's project manager, Levi Jensen, says the expansion and upgrades to the original system are nearly complete. The new wells should be ready to begin pumping water within the next year. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Catherine Wheeler in Gillette.
Wildfires and energy development have changed the western landscape, clearing hundreds of thousands of acres of native vegetation. It's fragmented the once massive sagebrush ecosystem, which is relied upon by hundreds of species. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports scientists are developing a new way to rebuild that landscape.
Several dogs pat happily through snow-packed grass on Red Canyon Ranch in central Wyoming. It's backed by rolling hills and grazing cows. Maggie Eshelman jumps out of her truck. She's a restoration scientist with the Nature Conservancy, an environmental nonprofit. She's interested in Red Canyon because of something that happened here nearly 20 years ago.
In 2002, there was a wildfire. It was started by lightning, so it was a natural fire. It burned down onto BLM land.
The blaze scarred the land, burning away the native sagebrush and other species that rely on it. Sagebrush is slow to grow back and was replaced by invasive species like cheatgrass. She says the Nature Conservancy wants to find a way to make the native vegetation the more competitive and resilient seed. That soon could happen with the help of a new seed technology. An experiment is underway on a plot in the distance here at Red Canyon, planted last fall.
As you go up the hill, there's some state trust land, then BLM land. And so our plots are kind of at the transition from state trust land onto BLM land.
The plot is growing sagebrush, but not with bare seeds buried underground like you might expect. They're encapsulated in an earplug-sized pellet called seed pods. It's a fertilizer clay nutrient concoction formed specially to help the seed survive. It could help native seeds grow, not only at Red Canyon, but across the many disturbed rangelands west-wide, like abandoned mine sites. There are well over 1,000 in Wyoming alone. Eshelman is spearheading the seed pod project for the Nature Conservancy. Wyoming's Department of Environmental Quality and the Bureau of Land Management support it. BLM's Gina Klingerman explains why the project is important.
We started this project as a way to address the impacts that are happening to the sagebrush steppe ecosystem because it is an ecosystem that is now in great peril. It once covered half of the United States, and now it's half of that.
Due to wildfire and development of energy, housing, infrastructure, the fall of sagebrush habitat is also a loss to the hundreds of species that rely on it, like sage grouse. For years, Klingerman says land was considered reclaimed if any vegetation grew back on it, even invasive grasses.
The soil is stable. but we're not seeing the shrubland community that belonged there or was there prior to the disturbance.
Nowadays, government agencies and companies are reseeding land to reclaim them, even with native seeds. But Klingerman says that status quo of just spreading bare, live seeds isn't effective.
That pure live seed, its survival rate is 5%. And so if we can increase that survival rate with the seed pods, then that's going to help those seeds get established quicker and they're going to get a better foothold.
The small plot lined with sagebrush at Red Canyon, that all started here. Eshelman weaves through a dimly lit warehouse before stopping in an industrial-looking room. It's her seed lab. A grow light hums, shining purple over tiny sagebrush sprouts. She's testing out different fertilizers.
So the ones that held the most promise then we'll try to incorporate into a pod.
Theoretically, each seed pod could be used for a different purpose. Right now, Eshelman has been mixing and using a pod recipe that makes sagebrush resistant to herbicides. Another seed pod recipe could insert nutrients into the soil where none was. Eshelman says that's important for abandoned mine sites.
Wyoming soil is not the best soil in the world to begin with, but due to the disturbance of the initial mining, but then also the reclamation of that mine, there are certain deficiencies within the soil.
That's why Eshelman isn't just testing out pods at Red Canyon, but two other sites, both abandoned uranium mines. The Nature Conservancy is excited at the prospect of seed pods at those sites to once again house a healthy shrub community. Seed pods could also help protect against too much or too little rainfall.
We want to be able to, regardless of what the weather might be that spring, put seeds out and have them successfully emerge and survive.
Eshelman says there's no one-size-fits-all seed pod recipe to help seeds grow, even in hostile environments. But she's still in the very early stages of the project. Eventually, the goal is to use it and start to rebuild the imperiled sagebrush ecosystem in Wyoming and across the West.
So if we want to keep the species around that are dependent on sagebrush and that ecosystem, then we really need to make strides towards restoring it, because at this point, we're not super successful at restoring sagebrush.
Eshelman will visit the Red Canyon site one more time in the coming months to count seedlings. Most of her time will be spent at the mine sites. Similar projects are underway in Nevada and Oregon this summer. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McCann.
Yeah,
powwow season kicks off on the Wind River Reservation this weekend with the 60th annual Eastern Shoshone Indian Days. Visitors will have the chance to see singing and dance competitions, try indigenous food, and shop native-made art and jewelry. There's also etiquette to keep in mind. Wyoming Public Radio's Tribal Affairs correspondent Savannah Marr visited powwow singers and dancers during an exhibition at the Wind River Casino and asked for their advice on being a respectful visitor.
My name is Danayla Augustine.
Theron Spoonhunter.
My name is Andrew Seahair.
Jasmine Bell, J-A-S-M-I-N-E.
First name is Herb, and my last name is Augustine.
My Arapaho name is Red Paint Tree, Pahati Bay.
All right, we'd like to welcome each and every one of you who are joining us here today.
So one of the biggest things about our powwow circle is that always go with the open heart, good feelings.
Oh yeah, yeah, there is some protocol for like some stuff that happens while the dances occur.
We do ceremonies, like we call it a dog dance. Like everybody has to stand up and nobody can take pictures or take videos or anything like that.
Another time is like if they're honoring somebody, they're doing an honor song for somebody, you know, you don't want to get out there and start dancing and, you know, acting all crazy and stuff.
We save seats, we'll put blankets on the seats, and a lot of people that are not familiar with the circle don't know that those blankets are there for a family to sit.
A lot of the regalia that is displayed, there are no two alike. It's made for that individual. You know, it's very personal to them. It's part of them.
So you don't touch their hair, you don't touch their dresses.
Kind of like not going right into the arena because like they could get like trampled or kicked or something.
And you know, that's just like a sporting event. You know, you're not going to run out in the middle of a basketball game.
If you want to take pictures, just ask the individual first.
Sometimes in different tribes, if they've lost a loved one or they're going through something, a hardship, they may not allow pictures to be taken of them.
If a person is visiting, you know, if they're curious about something, you know, all they have to do is ask someone.
I know a lot of non-native people are kind of scared to come to powwows. They shouldn't be because it's for everyone.
You know, it's a good place for gatherings, meet new friends, and keep up with the old ones.
When you're there, just enjoy yourself and enjoy the singers and the drum groups. You know, you see the dancers, they're entertaining, they're exciting, but people tend to forget about the singers. I always suggest to people that's never been to a powwow is go up and shake their hand, you know, introduce yourself and, you know, meet the singers, because without those singers, we wouldn't have a powwow.
When we come back, we'll be joined by Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards, who's authored a new book intended for young adults. And we'll have another installment of StoryCorps from Jackson. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Two twin girls set out on a quest to save a species on the brink of extinction. This is the premise of a new children's novel, Ocarina and the League of Crows. It's set in the American West in a distant, almost dystopic future. The girls, Zita and Isabel, can talk to birds, and so their quest is tied into the natural world in more ways than one. The book's author is Melody Edwards, also a reporter here at Wyoming Public Radio, and she joins me now to talk about the book and its message. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me. This is exciting.
So first up, why crows?
I have always been a little bit obsessed with crows. I find them fascinating. They're an extremely intelligent creature. They're considered sort of the primates of the sky. They're capable of just amazing feats of intellectual skill. So I've always found that fascinating, that they're amongst us. They're living above us. I have some living and nesting in my yard right now, and we've just been watching this family of crows up in our trees. And it's just like there's another whole world. There's rooms up in the trees, and it's just fascinating. I find them totally amazing.
You describe a lot of crow behavior in the book. How much of that is based in fact, and what did you learn?
It is as much based on real science of crow biology and language as I could possibly find and get my hands on. I mean, I'm a reporter. I can't help it. I find it so much fun to research all of this stuff. So I spent years, you know, just reading as many books about crows as I could, all sorts of scientific, you know, studies of them, and just kind of just jam-packed the book with as much of it as I possibly could.
There is some crossover in the book between the idea of human and animal. You know, there's cross-species communication and more. How do you see the line between human and animal?
Human beings are animals. And so I feel like that it's something that we need to remember more often, that we're all here on Earth together, that we're all miracles on Earth together, and that we're, you know, all species, we're all earthlings. As Jill Tarter, who I got to interview a couple years ago, said, and I think that's absolutely true. And, you know, I think that trying to show that by having this blurred line between these young girls who can talk to crows and who are discovering all sorts of fascinating things about their own lives. They're finding out that they're related to crows, and they are finding out that, they might even have crowness in themselves. And that is just really, I think, a way of exploring how we are all wild, and that we just need to let that fly.
How different was it to write a novel and a work of fiction as opposed to your, you know, sort of everyday bread and butter, which is reporting, and specifically reporting on wildlife?
They're very different. When I'm writing fiction, it's almost like I'm living in a dream. And, you know, I don't really think about anything else, and I'm kind of constantly, you know, thinking through the mind of my characters. But when you're writing journalism, you're very much, very rooted to the world. But I will say, what I do in journalism and the skills that I have honed as a journalist come in real handy when it comes to putting together vivid characters, vivid scenes. A lot of the science that is involved in this novel comes from sort of all this research. And so that was, I think that there's a tie there.
There's a good deal of immigrant characters in this book. And in fact, a main theme that sort of emerges in its own sort of futuristic way is securing energy as a way to secure borders. And you're also dealing with the extinction of species because of human activities. These are heavy topics. Why did you decide to put them in a children's novel?
Well, and that's why I ended up self-publishing this book, I think. I did have some people in the industry tell me that that was a little difficult, that, you know, having 12-year-old characters dealing with immigration and, yeah, like you mentioned, this sort of the energy issues and all of that, that those are some of the things that made it difficult to publish. But I feel like some of my favorite books are the Golden Compass series. And that was, again, a young character dealing with issues about religion, very serious issues. And I feel like my kids, when I read those books to them, they totally responded to that. And it prompted some important conversations. So as a parent, I feel like we shouldn't be hiding the problems that we are dealing with in our world. We should be finding ways to show children with volition tackling those problems in innovative and adventurous, strong ways.
Do you think we should trust young readers more to come to these conclusions and grapple with these topics themselves?
That's exactly right. I feel like young readers are wanting to, and they recognize that the hardest issues are being hidden from them, and that by putting these kinds of issues in books and in fiction, you're giving them permission to think about these issues and to start to make them their own.
Melody Edwards is a reporter here at Wyoming Public Radio and the author of Ocarina and the League of Crows, a new children's novel. Thanks so much, Melody.
Thank you.
Melody Edwards will hold a book signing and reading at Night Heron Books in Laramie Friday, July 5th at 7 p.m.
When StoryCorps came to Jackson last summer, Teton Science School Executive Director Chris Agnew asked former board member Gene Jorgensen to recall the school's early days and how it all started with the founders Joan and Ted Major.
How would you describe Teton Science Schools in the early days that you were involved?
Well, it was Ted and Joan's thing, the backpacking, and the superintendent of schools here at that time realized that this was a really good thing he was doing. So the superintendent said, hey, those kids should get credit for what they're doing. Mm-hmm. Oh, and here there's this school, old school bus. We don't need it in the summertime. Why don't you use it and take the kids a little farther out, et cetera. And so that was what it was about. And then someone said, hey, you should form a nonprofit organization, but you have to have a board. And so he rounded up the parents of these kids, and they were his board. And it was basically, it was board in pretty much in name only. Uh-huh. It was a rubber stamp outfit for Ted and Joan. And so that was kind of how it all began.
So would you tell me about a time when maybe a specific time or a specific memory where TSS made you feel hopeful?
Well, I do remember that there has been for many, many years a scholarship program for inner city kids from L.A. Mm-hmm. to spend time at the science school. And I remember that there was this group of kids for whom that was extremely, extremely important because they lived in the middle of smog-ridden Los Angeles and had never seen stars before. Yeah. And we have for many years been members of the Sierra Club, and their magazine would come to our house. And I happened to open it up to a page that said something like, I looked up and saw stars for the first time in my life, and this experience in Grand Teton National Park made the difference in my life. From this high school student who had hardly ever been out of LA and had not seen stars, it's just wonderful to see what is possible.
And now he and his wife are on our education advisory committee,
and,
too.
And she was a ranger here
exactly.
in this park.
So there are a couple that have done and will do great things.
And they are an inspiration to everybody.
That's Gene Jorgensen and Chris Agnew talking at StoryCorps in Jackson. This piece was produced by Alex Schaefer. Thanks for listening to this edition of Open Spaces. If you missed part of our program, you can hear the entire show or individual segments at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Just click on Open Spaces. You can also get our podcast on that site or wherever you get your podcasts. Anna Rader is our web editor, and this week interns Jeff Victor and Ivy Engel are filling in.
Thanks in part to those of you who support Wyoming Public Radio. We have received a large number of reporting awards this year. Last weekend, we received 3 awards from the Public Radio News Directors Association, including a first place for Open Spaces as the best news and public affairs program. And our friends at Human Nature won an award for best podcast. Our colleague Cooper McKim won a national Edward R. Murrow Award for his sound reporting on the historic Stonefly. You can support more of that news coverage with your pledge.
Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.